Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me today is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hello, Teresa.
It is very good to have you here and to return to our shows after a short interlude.
Yeah.
And we are, well, let's see, where were we last time we were?
Well, we were deep into the Holocaust.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap a lot of that up today.
Okay.
We're going to look at the Hungarian situation, which I think can certainly teach us some lessons. Also look at the work of Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty in the underground in Rome. Very interesting story there. And that can instruct us a little bit also. And then take a little look at the revisionist view of Pius the 12th. Why this man who did so much all of a sudden gets such a bad rap. And I think we can learn a lot from that also.
Great.
Oh.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Sounds like a lofty goal for one show.
And yes, it is. Yes, but with that, we should wrap up World War II, the Holocaust, all of those sorts of things, and then start moving off to bigger and better stuff.
Sounds great.
Okay. Well, I think the thing we have to consider is the fate of 400,000 Hungarian Jews. This was a country that was untouched by the Holocaust until 1944 because Hungary was an ally to the Axis powers.
Okay.
Admiral Horthy, the regent, held pretty much control over Hungary. And so throughout the war, he was an ally to Hitler, and therefore there would be no opportunity for groups like the SS to come into Hungary to do anything to hurt the Hungarian Jews. And throughout much of the war, they lived in relative peace and security, although people began to realize that this wasn't going to last forever. As the Third Reich began to crumble, as you go into the winter of 1943-1944, Hitler is being forced out of the Soviet Union. The armies are in retreat, or in the case of Stalingrad, the entire German army in Stalingrad is surrounded and crushed. Most of those men taken into captivity never saw freedom again. They were simply sent off into gulags and as I say, never returned to Germany. In Italy, you have the Italy falling. The fascist government is out. Italy sues for peace. And we'll talk a little bit more how that affects Rome during 1944. There's also the threat of invasion of France, which, of course, takes place in June of 1944. So the Third Reich is having some real difficulties. And with that, the German army decides then to seize the country of Hungary in order to safeguard its communication and supply lines to what was left of the Eastern Front. That meant that they had to overthrow their ally, Admiral Horthy, who did not go down without a fight. He rallied support, at least in the city of Budapest itself, and was able to maintain control of that city. But the rest of the countryside basically fell to the German army and its Hungarian ally, a movement known as the Cross Arrow, which was a very strident fascist organization. And so by October of 1944, with the exception of the capital city, the rest of the country was now in control, and now the SS could come in and begin its grim work. And as I say, especially in rural areas now, Hungarian Jews began to be caught up in this dragnet. This didn't come as a total surprise. For instance, earlier on, before these events took place, the apostolic delegate in Washington, D.C., a man by the name of Father Sigconini, had received an appeal from the World Jewish Congress for help. And so what they had done was they basically went back to the drawing board, went back to the notes of what Benedict the 15th had done during the First World War, and began finding ways in which the Vatican could use its church communications in order to help refugees. Remember, this is what had been done in the First World War. with Vatican sources and local dioceses, with POWs. That action had been mainly taken over by the International Red Cross by the last days of World War I, and became part of World War II's landscape also concerning POWs. But it sometimes worked and sometimes didn't work too terribly well. The International Red Cross had few teeth. The Red Cross was the constitutional weakness of the Red Cross is that the Red Cross operates within its own country. So what that means is that the care of POWs, allied POWs in Germany, would be done by the German Red Cross, just as the care of German POWs here in the United States would be done by the American Red Cross. Personally, I would rather have the American Red Cross taking care of me than the German Red Cross during World War II, for obvious reasons. So this was an action that was done beyond the Red Cross itself, and it's a cooperation between these two groups, the Catholic Church and the World Jewish Congress. And so what they had been, actually they had tried to do even before this, was to set up a system in order to take contributions that Americans would be contributing to specific families over in Eastern Europe, and to funnel those funds over there. They had done this with the Polish Jews when they could, and so this was something that was functioning. Also, there was a newly created organization called the War Refugee Board, which brought together all the different kinds of refugee agencies to coordinate all of this. This is rather late in the war that this takes place, but nonetheless, that's the attempt. The real action has to be done on the scene, and the individual who really shines out in all of this is Archbishop Angelo Rota. He was the papal nuncio to Hungary. He, of course, is pretty much caught in Budapest, but it doesn't stop him. He seems to have been just a real tenacious fellow. He went to the German army, to the command, and demanded explanations as to what was happening to the Jews. You know, and of course, he was ignored by the Germans. Finally, he had enough evidence to see that there were trainloads of Jews being sent off to Poland, and the first train that set out was on May 14th of 1944, and once again hounded the German command. What's going on? Why are these people leaving? Where are they going? And so he's not getting any real answers, but certainly trying to find out. Now, interestingly enough, while this is happening, there is a very strange story that that takes place around a rather enigmatic character named Joel Brandt. And this is covered, I think, probably better than any place else, is covered in Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews, which is a four-volume set. It's a massive study, and probably, I think, the best scientific study of this whole question. And Hilberg goes into several pages and documents beautifully the story of Joel Brandt. Brandt had been a Zionist organizer. He was one of those who had been traveling throughout Europe trying to encourage Jews to move, to leave Europe, to move to Palestine. This is what he did for a living. This was his job. And he arrived in Budapest in Hungary around the same time that the Germans took over the country, with the exception of the capital itself. And interestingly enough, he was kidnapped by a German army intelligence unit from the Abwehrdienst, army intelligence. And this was on March 19th of 1944. And he was taken to a safe house where he was hidden from the SS.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this gets to be very, very convoluted and very, very interesting. You have to understand that the SS had told the Jewish consuls throughout Hungary that that the people were being sent, that they were being rounded up, and they were being sent to what they referred to as resettlement camps in Poland. Interestingly enough, these Jewish consuls called Judenrat actually believed, or at least went along with this, even to the point at which there were two men who had succeeded in escaping from Auschwitz and had made their way down to Hungary to talk about the extermination that was going on. And the Judenrat in Hungary refused to believe this. It's one of those that area of time when this was so unbelievable.
Right.
It was easier to believe alien abduction.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I was taken up by spacemen and mm-hmm. they did experiments on my body, and here I am, and Area 51 and Roswell and all this kind of stuff. This, it seemed about as believable to civilized human beings as that stuff,
right.
And that's where they were. And so you have then this the situation in Hungary in which now the Nazis are rounding up all of the rural Jews. They're being sent off to this so-called resettlement camp. The Judenrat is going along with that. The Jewish consuls are going along with that. Joel Brandt is trying to convince them to, at least that's why he came, was to convince them, don't let them go to Poland for whatever happened up there. Give them to me, and I'll take them to Palestine. Somehow we'll get them out of the war. And now he gets kidnapped.
Okay.
And the agent behind his kidnapping is none other than an SS officer.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, this is really convoluted.
It is.
This is Adolf Eichmann.
Okay.
And Eichmann realizes, I mean, he's not the only one, but he realizes that the war is coming to an end, and it's not going to be, the treaty won't be signed in, you know, written in German. And so he realizes that, and so he's trying to save his hide in some way. So what he does is this. He comes up with this notion that if he could get the Jews worldwide, whom he considers to have lots of money, and if there is the World Zionist Fund, of course, that's helping to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine, if they would divert some of that money and buy for the German army 1,000 trucks, he would assure Joel Brandt the lives of 100,000 Hungarian Jews. So, in fact, the term he used was this: I am prepared to send you 1 million Jews, goods for blood, blood for goods. But the first deal was going to be 100,000 Hungarian Jews routed away from Auschwitz in exchange for 1,000 trucks, which he also promised would not be used on the Western Front, but only on the Eastern Front. Whether you could believe him or not, that's mm-hmm. a whole other thing. He goes so far as not only to hide Joel Brandt from the SS, but he also gives him $120,000 in order to carry out this mission.
Okay.
He smuggles him out of Hungary and gets him down to Turkey, where Brandt contacts the U.S. ambassador there in Ankara. He explains the deal that has been offered by this Nazi official. The ambassador then cables the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who shows some interest initially in doing this as a humanitarian act. However, the talks break down, and in the end, it is clear from Brandt's point of view that the ambassador was simply stalling and was not actually acting. It's believed, and we don't have any proof of this, but it's believed that Roosevelt talked to Churchill about this. And the Churchill said, no, don't do it, it's a trap. And it was a trap, but a trap for the British, not for the Americans. And the reason is that Palestine was a British mandate during the Second World War. If that deal had gone through and 100,000 Hungarian Jews found themselves in Palestine, the Palestinians would have turned against the British, which would have opened up yet another front.
Mm-hmm.
And so the British didn't want to play with this at all. And so the conjecture is that it was torpedoed by the British. We don't know that for a fact. We don't have those records.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly this was Brandt's take on the whole thing. realizing that he was not going to have any success then with the Americans because of the British, he then left Turkey and made his way to Syria. And Syria is more French controlled, at least during the 1920s, it was a French mandate. However, when he gets to Syria, he is arrested by the British, who then take him to Egypt and held him in jail. They would not talk to him, and they held him in jail while the 2 weeks went by. Eichmann had given him 2 weeks to do this mission, and so it didn't happen. And Eichmann then took the read as being that the Allies were not interested in the deal. And so by late July 1944, the trains then began rolling again, heading back up to Auschwitz, where they had gotten so good that they could kill Jews, Hungarian Jews, at a rate of 28,000 a day. Now, in the meantime, while the Brandt mission is ongoing, Archbishop Rota sent a letter to Pius XII talking about the deportation and forced labor that was going on, basically saying, this is what I've been told by the German army, is that the people are being taken to Poland for forced labor. He adds in that letter that he has heard rumors, and I quote here, by responsible people of an annihilation camp, end quote. So these are rumors. And Archbishop Rota is struck by the fact that these are not kooks. These are responsible people who are talking about there possibly being an annihilation camp in Germany. The response then from Pope Pius XII was to send a telegram to Admiral Horthy. It was sent on the 20th, well, it was actually a little earlier, 25th of June, and urging him to protect the Jews of his country. Admiral Horthy had sent a letter, a telegram back to the Pope, informing him that he was not in control of Hungary anymore, but he was in the city of Budapest, and for the present, people were safe in Budapest. Okay. It's only later on that a bishop in Eastern Europe gets solid evidence of annihilation camp, an annihilation camp at Auschwitz. And this is the Bishop of Bratislava. And he then takes the information that he has. Remember, all of this up until now has been conjecture. Remember, Gerstein makes his visits to Bishop Pressling and is not able to give any evidence, just on hearsay. But you know, we know later on that it was correct. There are other examples of another German officer coming to Cardinal Fallhaber of Munich, again telling the story, but not having any solid evidence. Here we have solid evidence, statistics, numbers, names of what's going on. And so he sent a letter to Pope Pius XII outlining all of this, and he put it in a diplomatic dispatch, okay, and he gave it to a papal courier. This was in May of 1944, and it's even a little bit earlier than the things going on in Hungary. Unfortunately, the courier got as far as Italy. Remember, this is war. You just don't, you know, travel around. And he got as far as Italy, and he could not get into the city of Rome. Rome had been taken over by the Allies, and it was a closed city at that point. It's not until October of 1944 that the Pope received the letter that had been sent in May that outlined specific events and evidence of the fact that they were killing people in Auschwitz. You know, people die in those camps. That happens. But these people were being exterminated. This was systematic extermination. And so the Pope really doesn't know this until then. There is, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this a little bit later on, there is this sense, especially by some non-Catholics, that the Roman Catholic Church is a top-down organization, so that whenever anyone goes into the confessional and confesses to a priest in, Brentwood, Missouri, that within 24 hours, the John Paul II knows about it. Well, that is so ridiculous, it's not even funny. And yet a lot of the revisionist historians base their arguments on this mm-hmm. top-down communication kind of a thing, which is obviously ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, by October of 1944, Admiral Horthy is himself arrested. Mm. His resistance in Budapest fails. Budapest is raided, not only taken over by the German army, but is raided by the SS. The Pope finds out about this, appeals to Cardinal Cerriti in Budapest itself to do something. Cardinal Cerriti is unable or unwilling to do anything about this. But once again, you have the Papal Nuncio, Archbishop Rota, stepping in. And he's very, very clever. The first thing he does is he goes once again to the German army. And he protests, and he's ignored. And then he goes back to his residence and then began issuing, running off, what he referred to as letters of protection. And these letters were from a Vatican source, you know, from the Papal Nuncio of Hungary, in which they argued that these individuals, that the bearers of these documents, were under the direct protection of the Vatican as a neutral country because they were baptized. Okay, and what they did was and this is incredible when you think about this. But what they did was they faked baptisms of something like 13,000 Jews.
Wow.
You know, they're working very quickly, and they ran these things off, and they faked these baptisms and said that these were no longer Jews, but Christians. Now, remember several programs ago, we talked about the whole thing about the Nuremberg race laws and what does it mean to be a Jew, and if you're a Jew because of religion, all this sort of stuff. And so he had hoped to be able to sort of razzle-dazzle the Nazis.
Try anything.
Yeah, anything. That's mm-hmm. exactly right. And it worked for several days. And finally, the SS said, no, we're not playing this game anymore. You can't rope-a-dope us. And so what happened was that the order went out that all Jews, you know, with or without protection letters, all Jews in Budapest were to be rounded up and sent off to Auschwitz. What happens then is absolutely incredible. You have a dragnet all throughout the city, churches, monasteries, convents, rectories, even embassies are raided. Now, embassies are extraterritorial. You're not supposed to touch this. They didn't make any difference. Didn't make any difference at all. And they rounded up thousands, because thousands of Jews are being held in cellars and root cellars and, you know, whatever, all over Budapest in Catholic institutions. And these were just summarily taken and taken off and removed then to Auschwitz. There, you know, and the nightmare goes on. Because when the Soviets arrived with the Red Army, they turned around and began doing the same thing to ethnic Germans and people who had collaborated with the Germans. And so thousands and thousands of them were carted off to similar fates in the Soviet Union. But I think the important thing for us to remember as we look at certainly the Hungarian issue and just the overall effort is in October of 1958, there was a memorial forest planted in Israel for Pius the 12th. They planted 800,000 trees in Israel, in this forest. They created a forest, basically, in his honor. And they did this because of all of the work that Pius had done to alleviate the suffering of Jews. There is, I would recommend to anybody, Ralph McEnany's book. It came out about a year or so ago, called The Defamation of Pius XII. And there's a whole chapter there in which he specifically, he does the legwork for us. He goes to all of the newspapers, the major newspapers like the New York Times, and he pulls up headlines, front page headlines of, and also editorials of these newspapers lauding the efforts of Pius XII. And editorial after editorial, what they do is they lambast countries, the International Red Cross, all kinds of other organizations, saying, why aren't you doing more? Look at the Pope. Look what he's doing for the Jews, and he's the only one who's speaking out. That's why the State of Israel planted those trees when they did. So it's important to keep that in mind. The question, of course, always comes up: could he not have done more? And I think the only answer to that is another question: who couldn't have done more? And then we have to, certainly here in the United States, before we start throwing brickbats at anybody, we have to remember the St. Louis affair, mm-hmm. and those 900 souls that had come within shout,
mm-hmm.
yeah, right, of Florida, you know, almost there, and then turned back to go back to death camps, and we're not alone at that, but certainly. There were an awful lot of things. A lot of people could have done a lot of other things. There's another book out, came out about 4 or 5 years ago, called Why Auschwitz Was Not Bombed. And it investigates, I haven't had a chance to read it, it's still sitting in my to-be-read pile, but it basically goes into all the reasons why the United States Army Air Corps did not use even a single bomber to destroy that death camp. And I hope to read it this summer, because the argument of this particular author is that we knew that the United States knew more about Auschwitz than it let on, and that it decided not to divert even a single bomber for that, because it would take away from the overall war effort, which is sad, because if you visit, for instance, Germany today. And you visit different cities and different places, and if you don't have to look very far to see things that were destroyed. They were carpet bombed. My nephew recently came back from a visit in Dresden, and he emailed my sister and said he couldn't believe the incredible devastation of the city of Dresden. Why? You know, it was firebombed. So that it actually caused a firestorm similar to Hamburg. Now, Hamburg was a port city. Dresden was famous for its ceramics. Now, not just little ceramic figures. Of course, it's famous for that, but it was also famous for those same ceramics could be used for electrical outlets and fuses and things like that. So it affected the war effort in some way there. On the other hand, you go to Mannheim, the city of Mannheim in the west, and not only was the cathedral bombed, well, maybe that was an accident, but they bombed the city zoo, destroyed the entire city zoo. Now, you know, if you're going to bomb a zoo, why not, you know, bomb Auschwitz? Or if not the camp itself, which would kill a lot of the innocents,
sure.
Why not bomb the railheads?
Right,
you know, and destroy the means of bringing people to there. But anyway, that's you know, I think there are more questions than answers on all this.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to take a look at what's going on in Rome, and particularly with the incredible story of Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty. This is chronicled in a couple books. Probably the best was J.P. Gallagher's Scarlet Pimpernel of the Vatican, came out in 1967. And this really begins telling the story. There are two or three biographies or histories of this period. And Gallagher was not there himself, but he drew on some of the others who were actual eyewitnesses and collaborators with Monsignor O'Flaherty. He was a notary in the Sacred Congregation for the Holy Office, which is now referred to, of course, as the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. He was very lucky to be from Ireland. Not only did it give him a gift of the gab and easy way with people, but also it's a neutral country. So it was not easy to arrest him, not only for the fact that he was a Vatican official, but also that he was a nationally neutral. He had started out with the Vatican Diplomatic Service, had been dispatched in 1935 to Haiti and to San Domingo. The next year, he was transferred to Czechoslovakia in 1936. And that was a hotbed of stuff going on there. That was kind of tough. And in 1938, he arrived in Rome, where he was given the office or the job of being a notary. Now, a notary in the office for the Sacred Congregation for the Holy Office was an investigator into theological irregularities. So his job basically was when someone said, "Oh, you know, this theologian wrote a book and there's theological error in it." He was one of those who would go early on and do the investigation to see whether or not there's any truth to that. And then, of course, afterwards, then there's a whole investigation that takes place. But what it did was it caused him to travel a lot, and which he enjoyed. And it also caused him to come to know a lot of people. As he traveled, he would get to know bishops in local dioceses and archbishops and cardinals and also a very involved Catholic laity. And so he just knew a lot of people. And he had this gregarious personality that everybody just kind of, remembered him and loved him. To tell you the truth, as I looked over a lot of this material, trying to think to myself, is there anybody that we can all relate to? You know who I thought of? Sure. Bishop Dolan.
Oh, sure.
Archbishop Timothy Dolan. Uh-huh. Same sort of, a personality.
Everybody loved him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and just easy with everybody, knew everybody, And so, as I say, he was very gregarious. He attended every party he was invited to. He went golfing with everybody who would play golf with him. He went to every dinner he possibly could. And what this is going to do is it's going to cause him to have lots and lots of contacts, which he's going to make very good use of later on. In 1941, while they were deep into the war, Pope Pius the 12th tapped him to be a translator. One of the things that was happening was that the POWs, many airmen were captured over Germany. Their planes were shot down, and they were sent to POW camps. Many of these camps, they consolidated English-speaking airmen, British, Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, Americans, into specific camps. And many of these camps were located in Italy. So these guys were being sent down to Italy. And as a result of that, the Pope had established a nuncio specifically for POW camps. This was a Monsignor Duca who didn't speak English. And so what he did was he used then Monsignor O'Flaherty as a translator. And so he would travel with him. Now, O'Flaherty was very clever. And what he did was he would meet with the POWs. He would get their names and their hometowns and other information like that. And then he would go back to Rome. And when he got back to Rome, he would have lists of these people that he would then take over to the Vatican Radio. And the Vatican Radio would send greetings from Italy in the name of Airman Charlie Jones of, Davinger, England, or whatever. And as a result of that, it's very clever, as a result of that, the families were able to find out that their family members were alive and well in a POW camp in Italy. And it was just a tremendous thing. Of course, the Germans didn't like it, and they didn't like the Italians didn't care for it much either, so that by Christmas of 1942, O'Flaherty was banned from any POW camps. he also, so he started putting his attentions in different areas. And one of the things he did was he established something of an underground railroad to help certain individuals escape from Rome and from Italy. One of the things he did was he had a lot of contacts with very wealthy people. In fact, many of them were noblemen, Italian noblemen. And he then began finding ways for some Jews and some anti-fascists who were in difficulties with the government. He found ways to hide them in people's homes and then eventually would smuggle them out of Italy. This was recorded in a fellow by the name of Sam Derry, wrote a book in 1960 called Rome Escape Line. And his book is particularly important to us because Sam Derry was a British air officer or artillery officer who was a POW who had escaped. He escaped to Rome, and with Monsignor O'Flaherty, he became one of the collaborators in putting together this this escape mechanism.
Okay.
And I'll talk to you about him a little bit more. In September of 1943, Italy now has succumbed to the Allied attacks, and Mussolini has overthrown. The new provisional government surrenders to the Allies, and when that happens, all throughout Italy, Italian guards at these POW camps simply walked off, which came as a real shocker, of course, to the German army, because the Germans had troops in Italy. They were fighting the Allies, but all of a sudden, to their rear, there was nothing but chaos. Something like 74,000 POWs all of a sudden got out, and many of them were hidden in the countryside by anti-fascist farmers who had had enough of Benito Mussolini after all these years. Others went to Rome with the belief that they could get to the Vatican, which was a neutral territory, and that they would be protected there. This was a very dangerous situation for the Vatican. For one thing, the Vatican's only about 100 acres, and it couldn't take literally tens of thousands of Allied airmen. And first of all, it just couldn't support that. Secondly, if you had that many Allied airmen taking over the Vatican, it would be a clear target to the Germans to forget extraterritoriality, which they did later on in Budapest anyway, and just go in there and slaughter everybody. So this was not a good move. And they realized it very early on as some of the airmen began arriving in Rome, making their way to the Vatican, and the Swiss Guard were given orders not to admit any of them. And so what happened is that they then were turned back into the city. This is where Monsignor O'Flaherty comes in. On September 10th of 1944, there was a pitched battle outside of Rome between two former allies, Italian troops on the one side and the German army on the other. The Italians were disorganized. They had surrendered. They didn't have a clear chain of command. The provisional government wasn't able to organize them quickly enough themselves, and so they couldn't stop the Germans under Marshal von Kesselring from coming in, and within 4 days Rome fell. There's a very sad account of one of the Italian officers making his way to the Vatican after he'd fought so hard and getting to one of the officials of the Secretary of State there, warning him that German paratroopers were marching down the Via Aurelia, and it was just a matter of an hour before they would take over Rome itself. Surprisingly enough, when they took over Rome, they did not take over the Vatican. They honored the neutrality of the Vatican. What they did was they painted a big, thick white line all around the Vatican itself and made very clear what was the border and what wasn't. You know. What happens then is that Father O'Flaherty realizes that there are literally thousands of these airmen who are trapped in Rome, and wants to do something to help them. And so what he did was he organized within the Vatican itself priests who were serving the Vatican, not all Italian, many of them from other countries, and they would work with him. Also, he received a very a nice donation of some 300,000 lire from an anti-fascist nobleman. This was Prince Doria Pamphili, who snuck 300,000 lire to him in order to help fund this operation. And so Father O'Flaherty set up what he called the Council of Three. He wanted this to be as small as possible. And there were three individuals who were going to organize this whole thing. It was himself. There was also a Swiss nobleman, Count Salazar, Salzfield Salazar. He was able to do what he did because, once again, he had great connections being a nobleman, but also he's Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
And then third, interestingly enough, was an Englishman by the name of John May. And John May was a cook and butler to the British minister to the Vatican, a man by the name of Sir Francis Darcy Osborne. And again, Darcy Osborne is a great help in putting together this story. And here's the British minister, not exactly, it'd be the equivalent of an ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, John May has become an expert. Because he's a cook and a butler.
And they hear everything.
Yes, that's right. And a butler did it. And one of the things he was very good at, he was considered to be the prince in Rome. And this is saying something. The prince of the black market. He would, if Darcy Osborne wanted mushrooms, he would know where to find them. If he wanted caviar, he'd know where to find them. So this guy is brilliant at knowing where all the stuff is. And so what happens then is that... they began gathering together this system, and as English and Australian officers, Canadian officers, are discovered, they're then ferreted out. And the most valuable one of all is Major Samuel Derry. Now, he was a member of the British Royal Artillery. He had been captured at the Battle of El Alamein, one of the great African battles with Rommel. A great tank battle. He was captured. He was sent to Italy and imprisoned at Chieti. There's a POW camp there. Eventually, the Germans were going to transfer all of the British at Chieti to Germany. And when they were in the process of doing that, their security was rather lax, and Derry succeeded in escaping. And he made his way to Rome.
Okay.
He comes in contact with O'Flaherty, and rather than escaping out of Italy, Derry says, no, let me stay with you. Let me use my military expertise. You know, he's a major. And he said, let me replace you as operations chief. He says, you know, you're a priest. What do you know?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing a good job so far, but there are things that you should not know. And so what it did was it allowed Monsignor O'Flaherty a certain deniability at that point. They have great success. By Christmas of 1943, they had smuggled out of Rome some 80 Allied POW. And outside of the city itself, there were some 2,000 POWs who were being helped out.
Wow.
By March of 1944... they had 150 Allied POWs, former POWs, who are escapees, hidden in Rome. And in the countryside, they could account for 3,200 others.
Wow.
So they had quite an outfit. Not only Britons, but also some 20 other nationalities were being helped out in this. It was also, they also had developed their own printing press and making false documents. Passports and work permits and things of that nature. One of the guys who was the organizer behind all of this, he was sort of like the assistant to Major Derry. He was given work papers as William O. Flynn. And he was an Englishman, but he was given Irish citizenship. And the cover was that he was an Irish librarian on loan to the Vatican Library. So, once again, a neutral, working for a neutral country, you know. Interestingly enough, the work permit that they got was actually, somehow, they actually got an officer at the German legation to sign this.
Oh my God.
I mean, right underneath their nose.
Oh.
There are all kinds of stories of daring escapes, and this is just not only the book itself, but I'd recommend to see the film The Scarlet and the Black with mm-hmm. Gregory Peck. Did a beautiful job on that. There's another story of a woman who was being helped out, and to get her out of the Vatican, what they did was they dressed her up as a Swiss guard. And so while they were doing a changing of the guard at the Vatican itself, she got slipped into the back of one of the units. And so there she was marching on the midnight shift, dressed up in that fancy uniform, mm-hmm. carrying a halberd. And it went on. They couldn't get her. You know, for hours. So there she was, marching with these other guardsmen for hours. And finally, at one point, the unit got around close enough to a colonnade, and Monsignor O'Flaherty, like, grabbed her and got her away. And then they got her into regular clothing, and she was able to escape. But just all kinds of just really interesting stories. And all of this, we have to remember, all of this was done under the threat of execution.
Oh, sure.
You know, O'Flaherty, any of these guys, if they had been caught, they would have been killed. Because not only was Rome full of German troops now, but also the SS. And then also there was another Italian fascist police force that were acting as allies. And they were, by all accounts, the worst of the group.
Mm-hmm.
The first days of German occupation of Rome was not bad. The fact of the matter was that the commandant of Rome was an Austrian air general who happened to be a devout Catholic.
Mm.
And so it didn't take long before they realized their mistake, and they transferred him out and brought in another, General Kurt Maetzler, who was aided by the SS Lieutenant Colonel Herbert Koppler. And Koppler plays a big role in The Scarlet and the Black, the movie there. He was very aggressive, very aggressive. In fact, at one point, he knew that O'Flaherty was involved in this stuff. He actually dressed up two SS men like Franciscan monks, smuggled them into the Vatican, and their intent was to kidnap O'Flaherty and bring him out and then torture him. And only through the alertness of a Swiss guardsman was the plot broken.
Wow.
And O'Flaherty was saved. Others were not so successful. Some were taken off to the prison, the Regina Caeli prison in Rome, and tortured by the SS. One of those was a priest, Father Anselmo Muster. He was from the Netherlands. He was a Dutchman, but he was involved with this himself. Here's a case where he himself was kidnapped on Vatican territory in the Church of Mary Major. And the SS came in and they kidnapped him. They took him off to Regina Caeli where they tortured him for 3 weeks. And then when he was about to be transferred to Germany, he was saved. And he was smuggled out and succeeded in escaping. One of the things that was very important was that Father Monsignor O'Flaherty actually had a mole within the SS headquarters on Via Tasso. This was an individual who was involved in the writing of orders, the day orders for the German troops and the SS troops, sometimes several days in advance. And so the raids would actually be set up, you know, 3-4 days in advance, and Monsignor O'Flaherty was actually getting copies of these before. And so hours before the raids would take place, they started moving people around so that no one would be caught. However, there was also a counter-mole.
Mm.
Within the household of a wealthy Italian family, one of the cooks was feeding information to the Germans. And ultimately, her role in this led to the recapture of 21 Allied escapees, along with 12 Italians who were collaborators, who were arrested and imprisoned, just remarkably, were not executed. In June 4th of 1944, Rome was liberated by the Allies. Almost immediately afterwards, Monsignor O'Flaherty and the other priests of the Vatican who were involved in this underground were honored by Great Britain, Australia, Canada, Italy. The United States awarded a Medal of Freedom for him. Probably the sweetest came for them. These priests came on Easter Sunday of 1945 when they were given a private audience with the Pope. And Sister Marciani speaks of this in one of her books. She says that the following: in a deeply moving tribute, the Pope thanked them for their assistance given to the Jews, specifically to the Jews, and she quotes him, "who are particularly dear to my heart," end quote. But the story doesn't end there. Monsignor O'Flaherty continues on in his Vatican service. In 1948, SS Lieutenant Colonel Koppler was arrested, as many Nazis were being rounded up throughout those 40s and 50s. And he was taken to Italy, returned to Italy, tried, and he was convicted of the murder of 335 Italians, specifically. And so for that, he received life imprisonment in an Italian prison in Rome itself. It is recorded that throughout the remainder of his life, he only received one visitor. It was not his family. It was not Odessa farmer SS members, nothing. Only Monsignor O'Flaherty.
Oh, my gosh.
A man that he had tried to kidnap and kill several times.
Wow.
Isn't that something? And in 1959...
Our present Holy Father, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. In 1959, he requested of Monsignor O'Flaherty to be baptized in the Catholic Church.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So, it's just an incredible story. And you just have to dig just below the surface, and you find hundreds of these stories, you know. And so, there it is. So, you know, you have to ask the question then, and this gets into that last segment, how could things have become so sour?
Mm-hmm.
How could you have somebody like last year, a book called Hitler's Pope, which was the recommended book for the history book club, and people were, everyone was talking about it. Another book, Under the Very Windows, in which... once again, the author claims that the Pope watched all of this happen and didn't do anything. Papal Sin, Constantine's Sword, all these have come out in the last couple of years, just lambasting the Pope. And then, of course, the mother of all of this, Der Stellvertreter, or in English, the Deputy, which was a play in the 1960s. Let's begin with the last one and just really quickly run through this. What happens is that there's a fellow, a playwright in the 1960s by the name of Rolf Hochhuth. He was an ex-Hitler youth, Protestant, and he is one that assumes, as we talked about before, that there is a tight hierarchy within the church, that the top knows everything that's going on. After Pope Pius XII died in 1958, he then begins his ravings against the church, and in 1963 produces the play Der Stellvertreter, the Deputy. It's interestingly enough, I mean, you know, where he gets the name of this, because during the Second World War, Pius XII was referred to by Nazis as, and I quote here, the deputy of the Jew God. Okay. Now, in this play, Hochhuth reverses reality and claims that Pius XII was the deputy of anti-Semitic Nazis. It's an absolutely ridiculous play. It has no historical merit at all. And yet... almost immediately afterwards, you have another cry of revisionist historians in the early 60s. While good history is being done, you also have, off on the side, these, like for instance, John Simon, who argues that that Pius chose Nazism over communism. Well, he should have talked to the Nazis about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of evidence that the Nazis didn't think too much of Pius. Another writer, the same 1960s, Panache Lapide, argues that he didn't do enough. And he concedes that Pius had saved at least 860,000 Jews. He says that in his own works. But later, he writes a book in 1967 in which he says, yes, look at all these Jews that he saved. 860,000 Jews could be attributed to Pius. But what did he not do? Why didn't he save everybody? You can't win sometimes.
No. Oh.
In 1965, another historian, Günter Löwy, writes a book called The Catholic Church in Nazi Germany. And his basic argument is that the Catholic Church is the guardian of human morality. She should have stopped us. Incredible. All this while there were good historians writing good stuff. And I would recommend people who want to read good stuff around this time would read people like Owen Chadwick, Alan Bullock, Raoul Hilberg, and go on and on, and a number of others. What happens is that there's a book that just came out in 2002 by a fellow by the name of Justice George Lawler. And it's called Popes and Politics. And in one of the chapters, he invents a new word. I think he invents it. It's called papophobia. Fear of the Pope. And I would just suggest that there is a sniff test involved in reading these books. If you start reading a book about Pius the 12th and World War II, and instead of talking about Pius the 12th, it's talking about Pius the 9th, you have to say, "No, well, what's that all about?" Or John Paul the 2nd.
Uh-huh.
You go, "Wait a minute, why are you talking about him? It's supposed to be Pius the 12th." There's a hidden agenda going on.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will also refer to Paul the 6th and bring up Humani Vitae. And you go, wait, that doesn't have anything to do with what you're supposed to be talking about. Best example of that is John Cornwell's, Hitler's Pope. In his introduction, he argues that Pacelli is a cynical, contrafugal force that is crushing the life out of the Catholic Church, first of all through the canon law of 1917, and then he goes on in his introduction and talks about Pope John Paul II doing the same thing, continuing this on, basically crushing the life out of the periphery, all the creative life of the Church. And what does that have to do with Pius the 12th in the Second World War? You know?
What kind of understanding is that?
Yeah. There are three I would really I would put up red flags for. Cornwall being one, James Carroll being another, Gary Wills being another. These are three current authors that have really taken out after the Church. But when you read their introductions, all of them have agendas that they're just in the process of unfolding.
Okay.
If you want good objective historians, I would recommend to you Ronald Reichlach. Has a book out about 2 years old called Hitler, the War, and the Pope. It's very objective. St. Louis University's Jose Sanchez.
Okay.
Pierre Blay. A number of others. You also are going to have, and Sister Marcioni, I think, did a good job too. You are going to have some that are going to be apologists for the Pope that kind of take their polemics off the line.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And also, but mm-hmm. if you're looking for solid history of the period,
of what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Reichlach and Sanchez are probably your best bets.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Father. Can we close today with prayer
Let's
and your blessing?
Yeah. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be,
world
without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.